I possess a certain store of wisdom about the fairer sex, and I can categorically tell you that women do not like it when other women wear their clothes without their asking. Gascoigne laughed. Cheered by this joke, he applied himself to finishing his luncheon with a renewed energy and a good humor. The truth of Moody's observation notwithstanding, it must be owned that his store of wisdom, as he had termed it, could be called empirical only in that it had been formed upon the close observation of his late mother, his stepmother, and his two maternal aunts. To put it plainly, Moody had never taken a lover and did not know a great deal about women. After this, there are nearly two pages of Moody's history with women, particularly his lack of experience with prostitutes. Then, two pages later, this exposition transitions back to the scene's present moment, with Moody addressing Gascoigne again. The truth was that he had never spoken two words together to a woman of Anna Wetherell's profession or experience, and would hardly know how to address her, or upon what subject, should the chance arise. And of course, he said now, we ought to be cheered by the fact that Miss Wetherell's trunk did not follow her to the wayfarer's fortune. Did it not? Said Gascoigne in surprise. The transition into exposition is simple. It happens with a paragraph break as the text jumps from Gascoigne's good humor to the beginning of the next sentence, the truth of Moody's observation notwithstanding. Then, at the end of the expository section, the transition back into drama is signaled with another paragraph break after the phrase, should the chance arise. Then comes a line of dialogue beginning and of course, and the adverb now after he said. These further signal the reader that the exposition is over and we're back at luncheon with Moody and Gascoigne. The previous example was about pausing a scene to provide exposition, but there are also scenes within scenes, which are usually flashbacks. Getting in and out of flashbacks can be pretty straightforward as well. If it's a short flashback, you might signal the shift in time by putting the whole flashback in italics, but that can be cumbersome. Too many words in italics can bristle at a reader. An easier way to transition into a flashback, especially if it's from the point of view of a particular character, is simply to say something like, Leo thought back to the conversation he'd had with Anna the day before, or Leo remembered what Anna had said to him, or something like that. There's a more subtle way, though, which I have often used in my own work over the years. I've always thought that starting a flashback with Kevin remembered or Stella thought back to when was clunky and mechanical. It seems like the literary equivalent of a transition to a flashback in an old movie, the kind where the screen goes wavy or a newspaper headlines come spinning towards the camera. So instead, I usually try to signal a flashback with a simple change in verb tense. In my novel Next, my character Kevin spends much of the story thinking about his past. The present-day action of the novel is about Kevin's trip to Austin, Texas for a job interview, and those scenes are written in the present tense. His memories and flashbacks, on the other hand, are in the past tense. Sometimes the text just switches straight from the present tense to the past, as in this excerpt. Kevin is standing on a pedestrian bridge in Austin and thinking about his father, who died when he was a teenager. Now Kevin knows why his father sang melancholy Sinatra songs in the shower, and the memory of his father's bass baritone, too low for Sinatra, he strained for the high notes, unexpectedly tightens Kevin's throat. It kills him to think he never put it together, the difference between what his father sang when he was alone and thought no one could hear, and what he sang when he was harmonizing with his barbershop quartet buddies two Saturdays a month. As you can see, Kevin's thoughts are in the present tense, but his father's actions are in the past tense. This passage leads to a 2.5-page flashback about the death of Kevin's father, all of which takes place in the past tense. At the end of the flashback, a policeman speaks to the young Kevin with his dialogue tag in the past tense. Then, in the next sentence, we return to Kevin in the present day, and he is thinking in the present tense. Are you Kevin? The policeman said with surprising tenderness. Wow, thinks Kevin on the bridge, and he palms the tears out of his eyes. I don't need this now. I really, really don't. But there's no stopping it. 35 years later, the night of his father's death, can still sneak up on him. Now, this technique won't work, of course, if the present day of your narrative is already in the past tense, which is the default verb tense of most fiction. In that case, you can signal a shift into the flashback by switching briefly into the past perfect tense. In that case, instead of saying, Kevin's father sang Sinatra songs in the shower, you'd say, Kevin's father had sung Sinatra songs in the shower. And then, to get out of the flashback and back to the present, you'd use a past perfect again just for a moment at the end. Instead of saying, are you Kevin, the policeman said, you would write, are you Kevin, the policeman had said, in order to signal the return to the main story. Let me give you a longer example. Here's a brief flashback scene from my first novel, The Wild Colonial Boy, in which a character named Jimmy Coogan, who was a member of the Irish Republican Army, remembers the time he stole an expensive Macintosh raincoat from a shop in London. He started along the beach through a fine mist of sea spray, and he pulled the wide lapel of the Macintosh all the way across and buttoned it. The Mac was an expensive one, a Burberry. He had tried it on in a posh men's store in Bond Street, turning this way and that in front of the tall mirrors like a woman, while the clerk fussed around him and tugged at his cuffs. Coogan had no intention of taking it, until he realized how his wife would scold him for it, and she did, telling him that it was his business to remain inconspicuous, that the Mac made him look like a bloody television correspondent. And even then, he had no intention of paying for it. He sent the man into the back for a box, and when the man was gone, he had slipped out the door as someone else came in. As this passage starts, Coogan started along the beach and buttoned his Macintosh in the past tense. But when he starts to remember how he stole it, the verb tense shifts into the past perfect. He had tried it on in a posh men's store. Then the bulk of the flashback takes place in the simple past tense because it was too awkward to write a long passage in the past perfect. Just like a long passage in italics, all those hads would bristle at a reader. Then, to signal the end of the flashback, I stick in one more instance of the past perfect. When the man was gone, he had slipped out the door, just before Jimmy returns to the present moment of the story. The effect is almost subliminal, and in principle anyway, the reader follows the shift into the flashback and out of it again without really having to think about it. So, to sum up, there are some scenes that are just little bursts of drama that can be truncated or incomplete, the way most of the early scenes in The Beggar Maid are. But most of the time, most of the weight in a narrative is carried by fully dramatized scenes. These major scenes are basically little stories within the story. Even if a major scene couldn't stand alone outside the context of a whole narrative, it should have the structure of a simple story with a beginning, middle, and end. In an earlier lecture, I talked about fractals, the mathematical concept of a pattern that repeats itself at every level of magnification. Now, I'm not saying that each individual scene should necessarily reproduce the structure or plot of the larger narrative, but it helps to remember that any story made of scenes is basically made of smaller stories. It's stories all the way down. Now here's an exercise to help you think about crafting scenes. Take an undramatized moment from a story of your own or from a story or novel you admire, and turn it into a full-fledged dramatic scene. In other words, take a moment that is only alluded to or depicted only briefly in an expository passage and dramatize it fully. For example, the moment that Hamlet learns that his father has died is never shown in Shakespeare's play, so you might dramatize that. Take as many words or pages as you need and turn it into a little story with a beginning, middle, and end. Don't worry about how long it is. But you also want to make sure that it contributes to the larger narrative. This will give you practice in making a scene self-contained as well as making it an integral part of the larger story. In the meantime, in the next two lectures, we're going to explore how the process of composition and the process of revision are linked, and we'll also talk about how to think about your completed narrative as a whole. Thank you.
Lecture 21. Should I write in drafts?
Up until this point in the lectures, we've mainly been talking about the individual elements that go into the writing of fiction. We've looked at creating characters, writing dialogue, constructing a plot, evoking setting, and choosing a point of view, among other things. And in the previous lecture, we talked about what I consider to be the fundamental building block of fiction writing, the creation of an individual scene. Focusing on these things makes sense, because from day to day and from moment to moment, you will spend most of your time as a fiction writer thinking about the particular task at hand, whether it's creating a vivid scene, providing a little bit of exposition or backstory, or just crafting the next sentence. The final shape of the whole narrative may always be present in the back of your mind, but in the heat of composition, you are more likely to be focused on the particular scene in front of you. But sooner or later, you will have to put the whole narrative down on paper, if you're old school, or you will have a complete computer file. Either way, whether it's a pile of pages or a pile of pixels, you'll have a completed draft. And at that point, you have to start worrying about whether the whole thing works or not. In this lecture and the next one, we're going to talk about working with the narrative as a whole. The process of composition and the process of revision are very closely linked, and you can't separate them completely. So I'll be talking a little bit about the process of revision in this lecture, but I'll talk about it in more detail in the next lecture. But to start with, let's talk about composing drafts. Many writers tend to create their works in complete drafts, and by this I mean that they write the whole narrative down from beginning to end before they start to revise, often several times in a row. I say many and not all, because some writers never write in complete drafts. Other writers take a different approach with each project, sometimes writing in complete drafts, sometimes not. I'm one of the latter. I've done it both ways, and I'll talk later on about how my practice has changed over the years. I'll also talk about some other ways of dealing with the whole narrative that other writers have used. But to begin with, I'm going to talk about the pros and cons of writing the whole narrative out, beginning to end, before you start changing it. Every completed writing project has at least a first draft. For some projects, for some writers, that first draft is also the final draft. But for most writers, most of the time, the first draft is not intended to be the finished work of art. In fact, it's not even supposed to be very good. In her excellent writing guide, Bird by Bird, the writer Anne Lamott came up with a famously salty way to describe that first effort. Please pardon my French, or rather, please pardon Anne Lamott's French. It's what she calls the idea of shitty first drafts. Here's what she says about them. All good writers write them. This is how they end up with good second drafts and terrific third drafts. People tend to look at successful writers, writers who are getting their books published and maybe even doing well financially, and think that they sit down at their desks every morning feeling like $1 million, feeling great about who they are and about how much talent they have and what a great story they have to tell, that they roll their necks a few times to get all the cricks out and dive in, typing fully formed passages as fast as a court reporter. But this is just the fantasy of the uninitiated. I know some very great writers, writers you love, who write beautifully and have made a great deal of money, and not one of them sits routinely down feeling wildly enthusiastic and confident. Not one of them writes elegant first drafts. I think Lamott and I must know some of the same people, or at least the same sort of people. I've read the first drafts of many of my writer friends, and none of them were ever very good. As a matter of fact, some of them shook my confidence in just how good my friends were. And when the finished story or book turned out to be very good indeed, I was secretly amazed that such a bad beginning led to such a great finished product. And to be fair to my friends, I'm sure they've had the same experience reading my first drafts. But that, I think, is Anne Lamott's point. The fact that first drafts are notoriously crummy is not an unfortunate byproduct of the creative process. It's a necessity. I'm going to commit a rather clumsy metaphor here, but think of writing a first draft as mining for gold. Bear in mind that everything I know about gold mining is from movies like The Treasure of the Sierra Madre or Charlie Chaplin's The Gold Rush. It's my understanding that you have to spend days and weeks squatting awkwardly in a rushing stream, sifting by hand through tons of dirt to get a few flakes of gold. I'm not saying that the proportion of dirt to gold in a first draft is necessarily tons to ounces, but expecting that first draft to be perfect is about as likely as Charlie Chaplin picking nuggets straight out of the dirt with his fingers. It just doesn't happen. Perhaps I'm laying it on a bit thick. I did warn you that it was a clumsy metaphor. Because it's also true that the experience of writing a first draft can also be thrilling. It's often a lot more fun than the more grueling and painstaking work of revision, and probably a lot more fun than panning for gold. In many cases, writing a first draft is your only opportunity to experience the story the way the reader will. In other words, it's the only chance you'll have to find your way through the story scene by scene without necessarily knowing what comes next or how it turns out. It's the only time in the creative process when you can fully experience the thrill of discovery. This isn't always the case, obviously. If you've already created a detailed outline of your narrative or you know how it's going to end, you won't be reading it in complete ignorance of what comes next the way a reader would. But, as I've said in earlier lectures, you're likely to encounter fruitful surprises while writing the first draft, even if you think you know where the story is going. These surprises will deepen or complicate the outline you worked out in advance. You may find yourself changing the outline or even throwing it away. You may even change the ending. I know that in my own work, most of the best bits, whether it's a plot twist or a sudden revelation about a character, came to me while I was actually writing a draft. I hardly ever get my best ideas by planning a story in advance. Even if you're working from an outline, and even if you think you know your final destination, during those early days of composition, you are an explorer, moving through territory nobody else has ever crossed before. Writing a first draft can also be thrilling because it's not supposed to be very good. It's not supposed to be elegant or shapely, and it's especially not supposed to be economical. In fact, perhaps the most fruitful approach you can take is to make your first draft your longest draft. In that first attempt, you should put in pretty much everything you can think of, and then put in some more. It's in your best interest to put as many of your ideas down on paper as you can without worrying too much about plausibility, consistency, or logic. Especially at the beginning of a project, you're likely to be bursting with ideas and possibilities, and you want to run with that energy as long as you can. So, dare to be crazy. Dare to be over the top. Also, dare to be boring. You don't have to worry about whether the first draft is ever going to be interesting to anybody else. Chances are, nobody's ever going to read it anyway, except yourself and maybe a few of your trusted readers. To sum up, a first draft doesn't need to be elegant, but it does need to be as comprehensive and all-inclusive as possible. There are two good reasons for writing a long first draft. One is pretty simple. The more stuff you put into it, the more stuff you have to work with later on. It's much easier to write more than you need in an early draft and then cut the superfluous stuff than it is to take a structure which may already have become fixed in your mind and pry it apart to add new scenes or characters. The other reason you want a long first draft is because, as I've already said, writing a first draft is a process of exploration. Until you have the whole thing down on paper, you won't even really know what the story is or who the characters are. No matter how much you plan in advance, the experience of making a story flow through your pen or through your keyboard can change what you thought you were doing in profound ways. My first novel, The Wild Colonial Boy, was about the Irish Republican Army. When I started it, I thought I was writing a politically radical defense of the IRA's guerrilla war against the British Army in Northern Ireland in the 1970s and 1980s. I was young then, in my late 20s, and I still had romantic notions about revolution. But by the time I had put the whole novel down on paper, my attitude toward my own narrative had changed completely. I realized I wasn't writing a pro-IRA novel anymore. Instead, I was writing a novel about the futility and cruelty of terrorism. It not only changed my view of the book, it changed my view of myself. It turned out I wasn't nearly as radical as I thought I was, and it took the process of writing down the whole story from beginning to end for me to see that. As Anne Lamott puts it, very few writers really know what they are doing until they've done it. I would also suggest that you write your first draft as quickly as possible. The time for the careful calibration of phrases, sentences, and paragraphs comes later. To begin with, you don't want to worry too much about pacing and what works and what doesn't, or even about consistency. As I said in my very first lecture, I've been fond of quoting a slogan from the English rock and roll musician Nick Lowe. Along with being a great songwriter and performer, Nick Lowe has also earned a reputation as a producer for other artists such as Elvis Costello, and his nickname as a producer has always been Basher. This comes from his motto in the recording studio, which is, bash it out now and tart it up later. I think this motto works just as well for fiction writing. Not only will writing quickly help you get as many ideas on the page as you can, something of that energy may very well survive into the finished work. The mystery writer Michael Connelly has said something similar. In an interview in the New York Times, he talked about how his years as a crime reporter informed his technique for writing fiction. Here's what he said. Momentum in writing means momentum in reading. There is a prevailing school of thought that something good must take time, sometimes years, to create and hone. I have always felt that the books I have written fastest have been my best, because I caught an unstoppable momentum in the writing. Now, I don't endorse Connolly's philosophy entirely. I don't believe that writing faster is always better. But there's a lot of truth to what he says. The headlong momentum of a first draft can often carry over even into the finished product. Any writer at every level of experience can take advantage of this advice. But I think it's especially true that writers who are just starting out, and especially first novelists, should write their first drafts quickly. MFA programs, creative writing classes, and a course like this one can be very helpful. But in the end, you learn how to write a book by writing one. You learn by trial and error, and for that process to be fruitful, it may actually help you to write an expansive, baggy, inconsistent, very likely unpublishable, and maybe even unreadable first draft. This is the way I learned how to write novels, at any rate. I never even finished my first attempt at a novel. Instead, I gave up after writing 200 truly bad and spectacularly dull pages, which will never again see the light of day. But I then went on to write 4 handwritten drafts of The Wild Colonial Boy. As soon as I finished the first draft of the book, I typed it up on a typewriter because that's how old I am. Then I showed it to a few people and got some advice. After that, I sat down and wrote the whole thing out again in longhand and typed it up again. Then, after a third handwritten draft, also painstakingly typed by me, I sent it to an agent. This guy very generously gave me some of the best advice I'd ever gotten on a manuscript, and I wrote the final draft, again in longhand, while I was attending the Iowa Writers' Workshop during the late 1980s. I typed this final draft on my first computer, a leading-edge Model D, for those of you who remember the Paleolithic era of personal computing. With some minor revision, that was the version that ended up as my first published novel. And I'm convinced that it wouldn't have been publishable at all, and I wouldn't be here talking to you, if I hadn't slogged through those 4 handwritten drafts. But not everyone writes books that way. In fact, during the heyday of the novel in the 19th century, it was probably uncommon for a writer to compose several complete drafts of a novel before publishing it. Back then, many novels were published as serials, meaning that they were published in weekly or monthly installments in newspapers or magazines over the course of a year or two. Charles Dickens is especially famous for having written his novels in installments, sometimes working only 2 weeks ahead of publication. For example, he started writing David Copperfield in February 1849, and the first installment was published only 3 months later, on the 1st of May. He didn't complete the book until November of 1850, which means that the public had already started reading David Copperfield long before Dickens finished writing it. This also means that Dickens never really did more than one complete draft of David Copperfield. Because he wasn't working with complete drafts, he needed to have thought the novel through in great detail before he even started writing. As the British writer Peter Ackroyd says in his biography of Dickens, "Never was a writer so exact, so thorough, so careful in his plans. He told one contemporary that the plot, the motive of the book, is always perfected in my brain for a long time before I take up my pen. And he told another that he never began to write before having settled the work in its minutest detail in his head." Dickens may have done drafts of individual chapters or sections, and he certainly rewrote things as he went along. And the further he got into the story, it's entirely possible that he may have changed his mind about the later chapters, the ones he had outlined but hadn't written yet. For example, his novel Great Expectations originally had a different ending than the one he ended up publishing. But Dickens did not have the option of making any changes to the chapters that had already been published. He could not go back and change an early chapter to make it consistent with a new understanding of the story or a character. That may have handicapped him as far as plotting went, at least in comparison to a modern writer, who has the freedom to go back and fix a mistake. And yet, much of Dickens' work has an irresistible narrative momentum. This momentum is partly the result of Dickens' own boundless energy, but it is also a product of how he wrote the books. On deadline, a chapter at a time, just 2 weeks ahead of the printer. And so the commercial realities of publishing serial fiction in the 19th century affected the daily creative process of writers. The publishing business back then dictated that books be written on the fly, without repeated drafts. In our own time, changes in technology have also caused changes in the way that writers compose a whole narrative. As I mentioned at the start of the lecture, my own process has changed over the years. I haven't written more than one complete draft of anything since my second book, a collection of three novellas called Publish and Perish. In that case, one of the novellas went through at least two complete drafts, and the second one was significantly different from the first. But at least one of the novellas, called Queen of the Jungle, was written essentially as one draft in a white heat. And the published versions of each of my three subsequent books, all of the novels, are essentially first drafts. I didn't do this because I wanted to emulate Dickens. Rather, the reason I changed my method is because I started to use a computer. Even before PCs, I knew people who actually composed on a typewriter, but I could never work that way myself. When I'm writing, I make a lot of false starts and I change a lot of things as I go. I often go back to the very beginning of whatever section I'm working on and change it significantly. Sometimes I just scrap the beginning entirely and start over from scratch. This means that when I was still writing fiction in longhand on legal yellow pads, my manuscript pages were full of sentences that I had drawn a line through and even whole passages that I had crossed out. I also made a lot of changes by turning the page sideways and writing in the margins. Back in the era of the typewriter, there was something final about actually typing up these handwritten drafts. Any change you made after you typed up your draft meant, at the very least, messing about with whiteout or correction tape. Sometimes you'd have to retype an entire page or even several pages, and sometimes you had to repaginate the whole thing. Changing the typescript was so cumbersome and time-consuming that it made sense to do all my actual composing in a handwritten draft, where I could be as messy and indecisive as I needed to be. But when I started to use a personal computer, I discovered that the handicaps of typewriting disappeared. I could make changes in a computer file just as easily as I could write passages sideways in the margins of a page. Even more easily, in fact. I no longer had to transcribe changes from a manuscript by correcting or retyping a typescript. And I no longer had to decipher my own dodgy handwriting while I was typing. I could make the change instantly in the file, at will, without having to print anything out. For example, if I wanted to move a whole passage from one chapter to another, I could simply copy and paste it, rather than having to retype the whole section. And if I wanted to save different versions, I could do that too, without wasting any paper. As a result, I composed nearly all of my second book, Publish and Perish, on a computer, though, as I say, I did at least two complete drafts of one of the novellas. When I wrote The Lecturer's Tale, my third book and second novel, I never did more than one complete draft of the whole book, even though each of the individual chapters went through multiple drafts. As I explained in my last lecture, the plot of The Lecturer's Tale is basically an excuse to string together a series of satirical set pieces, and each one of those set pieces was rewritten several times. If you were to add up all the different versions of each chapter, it would probably amount to several complete drafts of the whole book. But it was still different from the way I wrote The Wild Colonial Boy, where I wrote all the way to the end of the book without revising individual scenes before going back to the beginning and starting over. With The Lecturer's Tale, I didn't advance to the next chapter until the previous one was more or less finished, so that by the time I finished the final draft of the last chapter, the book was essentially done. With my next book, Kings of Infinite Space, I moved even further away from doing complete drafts. This novel is an office comedy about a failed academic who ends up working as a temp for a Texas state agency. I got the idea for it while I was still working on The Lecturer's Tale, so I couldn't get to it right away. As a result of this delay, the book marinated in my brain for a year before I ever started writing it. When I finally got around to it, I wrote it faster than I've ever written a novel before or since, in a rather feverish 8 months. Kings is a plot-driven book, and since I'd had a year to work the story out in my head, writing it down was actually pretty easy. As a result, I moved even further away from doing drafts than I had in writing The Lecturer's Tale. I spent the most amount of time on the first three or four chapters. I wrote them over and over again, slowly perfecting them so that each time I rewrote them, I made fewer changes. Then, when I had the opening section of the book more or less squared away, the later chapters came easier because I already had a firm foundation for the characters, the plot, and the setting. In fact, the further I got into the book, the fewer drafts of each chapter I did. Many of the later chapters in the book are essentially first drafts, with only minor changes from the version I created on the day of their first composition. This was a pretty radical shift in my creative process, and there are several reasons for it. One, as I've already said, is the change in technology. Making changes to a text on my laptop is easier than scribbling in the margins of a handwritten draft, and a lot faster. Though it may or may not be easier on my hands, since I probably exchanged writer's cramp for carpal tunnel syndrome. But perhaps just as significant is the fact that I'd become a more experienced writer. When I was writing The Wild Colonial Boy, I was essentially teaching myself how to write a novel. Plowing through all those handwritten drafts and hammering out all those typescripts on my Smith Corona was the best boot camp this young writer ever had. By the time I was writing Kings of Infinite Space, I was no longer teaching myself how to write dialogue or build suspense. I could just sit down and do it. As always, I don't want to say that there's only one way of doing things. No doubt there are many experienced writers who continue to write in multiple complete drafts throughout their career. And no doubt there are some rare novices who dash out a masterpiece on the first go. The Beat writers, for example, believed in the motto, first thought, best thought, which was coined by the poet Allen Ginsberg. Not being a fan of the Beats myself, I'm not sure I'd endorse that sentiment. But you should do what works best for you and not necessarily listen to me. As I recall, Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac didn't do too badly. In the end, Whether you write multiple drafts or only one depends on the nature of the project. Even though I haven't written in complete drafts since my first book, I also haven't used the same method twice. Each book has been written in a slightly different way. My most recent novel, Next, was written in a similar fashion to Kings of Infinite Space, but with a crucial difference. As with Kings, I wrote the opening section of Next over and over again until I was more or less happy with it before proceeding to write the rest of the book. But Kings was a plot-driven story that happened in chronological order. Much of the story of Next takes place in flashbacks that do not occur in chronological order. In one chapter, I might have my main character, Kevin, think about something that happened only a few months ago. But in the following chapter, he might recall something that happened 40 years ago, during his childhood. As a result, the further I got into the book, the more I learned about Kevin. And the more I learned about him, the more I had to go back and incorporate my new understanding into chapters that I had finished many months earlier. This happened all the way through the book. Even as I was writing the final chapter, I found myself having to reconfigure and revise earlier sections and even the opening pages. Writing Next was like the composition of Kings of Infinite Space in one respect. By the time I had finished the first complete draft of each book, I was more or less done. But on a daily basis, writing Next was a much messier and more complicated process than writing Kings. It also took much longer, 2.5 years as opposed to 8 months. I also have to admit that, as I've gotten more experienced, I no longer follow one piece of advice I gave you earlier in the lecture. The first draft of my first novel, The Wild Colonial Boy, was indeed the longest and most rambling and digressive of the four drafts. But now that I write drafts of individual scenes rather than complete drafts of the whole manuscript, I find that my early drafts of each scene are usually shorter than the later drafts, not to mention the finished version. In fact, at this point in my career, I've turned into a different type of writer. One reader of mine called me an accretive writer, by which he meant that each new draft I write gathers a little more material, the way you might roll a snowball through the snow to turn it into the bottom half of a snowman. This may not work for you, obviously, but it's worth taking a look at, and I'll explain my current practice in more detail in the next lecture. It's been difficult to think of an exercise for this lecture because any exercise that involves the creation of a complete draft goes well beyond being an exercise, obviously. But I can suggest that you take some of the different techniques I've mentioned in this lecture and try them out for yourself with a scene or a chapter. For my younger listeners who have spent their whole lives on a keyboard, you might try picking up a pen and a pad of paper and seeing if you can draft a whole scene in longhand without typing a word. Even though I no longer write whole books or even whole chapters by hand anymore, I still sometimes sit down with one of my old yellow legal pads and write a few paragraphs in my indecipherable handwriting. Writing by hand is more time-consuming than typing. It can be a very fruitful way to make yourself slow down and think about what you're trying to accomplish. But if that sounds too 19th century for you, try something like this. Think about how you normally compose a scene or a chapter, and then try the opposite technique. In other words, if you're the sort of writer who dashes through a scene without looking back, try slowing down and revising as you go. Write your first paragraph over and over until you think it's perfect before proceeding to the next one. Or, on the other hand, if you're already the sort of writer who revises as you go, throw caution to the winds and try typing out a scene as fast and furiously as possible. Don't stop and don't look back. In either case, you may hate the result, in which case you can go back to your old way of doing things, no harm, no foul. Or you might find that sometimes, for certain purposes, changing your process can lead to interesting results. As I say, I've done it both ways, and both ways have worked for me. In my next lecture, we'll look at the process of rewriting and revision, which most writers will tell you is about as much fun as doing your taxes. But most writers will also tell you that revision is where the real work of fiction writing gets done. So sharpen your red pencils. Thank you.
Lecture 22, Revision Without Tears.
Revision comes to all of us, like death and taxes, and it's just about as much fun. In the earlier stages of composing a work of fiction, you're often caught up in the thrill of discovery. You're creating new situations and characters that no one has ever seen before. Whatever frustrations you may experience in the act of creation are often made up for by the sheer pleasure of making something new. But then, having created this beautiful, lively, imaginative, world-changing draft, you now have to sit down and look for everything you did wrong. Revision is about confronting your own mistakes, which were usually made with the highest hopes and the best intentions, and fixing them in such a way that the reader never knows there were any mistakes to begin with. Not only can revision be hard, unpleasant work, it can lead to despair. The novelist John Gardner, our friend who wrote The Art of Fiction, was once so frustrated with his novel Grendel, which is a retelling of Beowulf from the point of view of the monster, that he threw the manuscript into a fire. Luckily, his wife retrieved it before it could burn, and when Gardner calmed down, he went back to work and finished it. Not all of us take such drastic action to avoid having to revise, but at one point or another, we've all felt the same way John Gardner did. When you reach the end of a draft that you've composed in a white heat, you can believe that you're the greatest writer since Shakespeare. Then when you read it over the next morning, you can feel like the worst hack who ever drew breath. It's enough to make you want to give up and go to law school like your mother wanted you to. Much of what makes revision difficult is that you have to consider your draft on every level, more or less all at once. It's the one time in the whole process where you cannot avoid having to think about everything. Not only do you have to ask yourself if the entire narrative works as a whole, you have to ask yourself if all the individual parts do what they're supposed to, and if they all pull in the same direction. Is each character complete and believable? Did I use the right point of view, the right verb tense, the right setting? Does each chapter round off and lead to the next? Does each scene? Are my sentences interesting, elegant, and memorable? Having to think about all of this at once is daunting, to say the least, but there are ways to approach it that can make it less intimidating. The first step of revision is to start thinking about it from the very beginning of your project. You need to prepare for it from the moment you first start writing. Remember that saying from Nick Lowe that I mentioned in the last lecture, bash it out now and tart it up later. For the longest time, I used to keep that motto on an index card that was taped to the wall over my desk. In the last lecture, I cited it mainly as a reminder that you should forge ahead as energetically and heedlessly as necessary to create your drafts in the first place, that you shouldn't worry too much to begin with about length, consistency, economy, and so on. But look at that motto again, and take note of the fact that it comes in two parts, bash it out now, and then tart it up later. Both halves are equally important, and that second half serves as a subconscious reminder that even during the honeymoon period when you're making something new, getting the story down is only the beginning of the process. The motto reminds you, even during the heat of composition, that you're going to have to change things later on. In other words, composing and revising are inextricably linked. How you revise depends in large part on how you compose the draft in the first place. As I explained in the last lecture, there are different ways of composing drafts. You can write a whole draft of a complete narrative without looking back, or you can do individual drafts of each section or chapter before you go on to the next one. By choosing one of these methods over the other, you're necessarily choosing how you're going to revise. If you write a whole draft without looking back and don't start revising until it's done, then you've got all the revision to do at once. This may make revision seem grim and joyless because you're looking at rewriting days or months of previous work. Still, forging ahead without having to worry every day about what you wrote the day before can make writing that first draft easier. On the other hand, if you work and rework each individual section before you proceed to the next one, you'll be revising as you go. This may make the revision a little less daunting since you do it in easy stages and not all at once. It becomes part of your daily routine. Of course, revising as you go is no guarantee that when you've reached the end, you still won't have to go back and fix mistakes or even make major changes. Even with the second method, you still reach a point where you have to think about whether the narrative works as a whole and whether all the individual parts do what they're supposed to do. Now that I've scared the bejesus out of you, let me suggest some ways of approaching revision so that you don't feel depressed or intimidated. And the best way to do that, I've decided, is to use an example from my own work, and so I beg your indulgence here to inflict some of my prose on you. My excuse is that I have access to my early drafts and I can remember what I was thinking when I revised them, which I don't have and can't do for other writers. With that excuse out of the way, let me talk about how I revised the opening paragraphs of my second novel, The Lecturer's Tale. In 1997, I published a book called Publish and Perish, which was a collection of three novellas. Each one of these novellas combined supernatural horror with academic satire. The Lecturer's Tale was originally intended to be one of the novellas in Publish and Perish, but the more I worked on it, the longer it got, and it ended up as the longest novel I've written so far. Since I'm talking about the opening paragraphs, you don't need to know much about the book. Suffice it to say, it's the story of Nelson Humboldt, a failing academic who, in the first chapter of the book, loses his right index finger in a freak accident on the quadrangle of the campus where he teaches. The supernatural element in the story comes from the fact that after Nelson's finger is reattached, he discovers he can make anybody do anything he wants by touching them with his reattached finger. Since this is also an academic satire, he uses this power to save his teaching job and then, as he becomes more corrupt, to work his way up to the top of his university's English department. It was intended to be a sort of mashup of Faust and the Broadway musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Here's my original version of the first paragraph, back when I was thinking it was only going to be a novella and not a novel. Bear with me. This is kind of long, and it's not very good. Crossing the quad at noon on a gray Halloween, Nelson Humboldt's finger was severed in a freak accident. Oddly enough, he hadn't been hurrying as he usually did at this time of day, and anyway, Nelson was a tall fellow, standing a full head taller than many of the young people around him. If anyone could see where he was going, it was Nelson Humboldt. On the other hand, this was the busiest class change of the day, as students entered the quad from all four corners at once, in a vast, slowly moving press that swirled with complex currents and eddies. Out of the eddies, little knots would form, students talking loudly in the brisk, damp autumn air, each with a backpack slung over one shoulder. Even when he was in a hurry to get to his next class, Nelson loved this scene. It was the epitome of what life at university ought to be. Bright, good-humored, energetic young people chattering happily about their classes, their lives, their loves, in a hurry to be somewhere else. Unlike many of his colleagues, unlike most of them, truth to tell, Nelson tried to be a fundamentally cheerful man. It seemed to him that all of life should have such heedless momentum. All of life should be so full of hope. But today, Nelson was unusually distracted, and this, he decided, was the reason for the accident. He had just come from the cramped office of the undergraduate chair of the English department, where Nelson was a lecturer, and just 10 minutes before, she had told him compassionately but briskly that the department was being forced by budget necessities to terminate his appointment at the end of the semester. This meant not only that his income would stop on the last day of the year, just after Christmas, and that his academic career had now become well and truly dead in the water, but that his health insurance for himself and his family would end in 8 weeks. Nelson had no savings to speak of and no prospects, the job market being what it was, and now he was about to have no job. and he moved much more slowly than usual through the press on the quad, still in shock, his mind elsewhere, letting himself be buffeted by the currents and eddies of the passing students. The loss of his finger was just the last straw. I think you can see what's wrong with this, as I did when I was writing this lecture and looked at it for the first time in nearly 20 years. The passage doesn't really work on any level. It doesn't work on the micro level of sentences and phrases, which tend to pile up without going anywhere. And it also doesn't work on the macro level of the narrative as a whole, or at least what I imagined the complete narrative to be when I started. A lot of the sentences are just plain clumsy. The very first sentence is a particularly egregious example. Here it is again, in case you fell asleep. Crossing the quad at noon on a gray Halloween, Nelson Humboldt's finger was severed in a freak accident. Grammatically, that sentence makes it sound as if it was Nelson's finger crossing the quad, not Nelson himself. Another problem is that the very first paragraph doesn't really do what a first paragraph is supposed to do. As you may recall, a first paragraph is supposed to intrigue the reader with a character or a situation, and it is supposed to suggest something about the narrative to come. After telling us that Nelson has lost a finger without telling us how, the first paragraph dives down the rabbit hole into a sentimental, metaphorical description of how students mingle on the quad at the center of campus. After that pointless digression, the second paragraph shoehorns in the bare minimum of Nelson's backstory without giving us any visceral, individual details that bring Nelson and his situation to life. We know he has a wife and kids, but we don't know anything about them. We can't see them at all, and we can only barely see Nelson. The only thing we know about him as a person is that he's tall. In fact, that's the worst fault of the whole passage. I opened this narrative with nothing but exposition, with nothing but an undramatic summary. The sentences are clumsy and rambling and inelegant, and there's no evocative detail, and the passage doesn't really suggest much about what is to come. If it had been somebody else's book, I'd never have finished reading that first paragraph, let alone the rest of the story. So, I tried again. Alas, I regret to say that in the second version, the first paragraph didn't change much, so I won't inflict it on you again. But I began to make more of an effort in the second paragraph. Here it is, version 2 of the second paragraph. But today Nelson had been badly shaken, and perhaps he hadn't been watching where he was going. He had just come from the Spartan seventh-floor office of Victoria Victorinix, the undergraduate chair of the English department, where Nelson was a visiting adjunct lecturer. Just 5 minutes before the accident, Professor Victorinix had told Nelson politely but coolly that the department was being forced by budget necessities to terminate his appointment at the end of the semester. Professor Victorinix was a small, slender, steely woman with cropped silvery hair, a penetrating gaze, and the trace of a bemused smile always about her mouth. Nelson appreciated her forthrightness and the fact that she looked at him as she sacked him. Indeed, it was Nelson's glance that roamed all over the white walls and spare, elegant shelves of her office as he swallowed hard and tried not to cry. The emotion would have been an honest response on Nelson's part, but tears wouldn't have changed anything. Professor Victorinix had suffered 25 years of being ignored, condescended to, and worse as a gay woman in academia, and she was unusually immune to the self-pity of wounded young men. "You have our gratitude, of course," she said, "for all your efforts on behalf of the department. Though I realize that under the circumstances, that may not mean much to you." This, if I do say so myself, is an improvement, though it still had a long way to go. The bare, unevocative summary of the first version is gone. You get the rudiments of an actual scene with two characters who were actually interacting with each other. One of them even speaks. The second version is better because it's more dramatic. In other words, it's better because I have slowed down and started to show rather than tell. Now, at least, the second paragraph of the lecture's tale was beginning to do what the opening of a narrative ought to do. It puts the reader in the middle of a situation, in medias res, with just enough information to make it intriguing and to suggest what's coming, but without giving everything away. Instead of just telling you what Nelson's problem was, I put him in a room with someone else and showed the situation to you. And not only does that new second paragraph work better on the macro level of the whole narrative, it works better on the micro level of sentences and evocative details. Instead of the nameless, faceless woman who speaks to Nelson compassionately but briskly in the first version, we get a woman who has a name, Professor Victorinix, and she has a physical description. She's small, slender, and steely, with cropped silvery hair and a penetrating gaze. She also has a history. She's a lesbian who has been in academic for 25 years, and she has a personality. She is polite, but chilly. In my original conception of the story, this character only served one function. She was intended to fire Nelson in the opening chapter, after which she was never supposed to appear again. And when I was writing this revision of the opening, it still hadn't occurred to me that she might be anything more. I just wanted to make that opening passage more visceral. This meant I had to make it more of a scene, which meant, in turn, I had to make her more of a character. Now, before I read you the version that appears in the finished book, I want to remind you again that revision often requires you to think about everything at once, from the level of the phrases and the sentences to the nature and importance of individual characters, and all the way up to the shape of the narrative as a whole. The Lecturer's Tale was my third book, but only my second novel. As I told you in the last lecture, I wrote it differently than I had written my first novel. With The Wild Colonial Boy, I had written out four complete drafts by hand. With The Lecturer's Tale, I first used the method that I still use now. I revised it as I went, more or less finishing one section before I moved on to the next, so that by the time I got to the end, the book was more or less finished. But the operative phrase here is more or less, because with The Lecturer's Tale and with every book since, I have found myself having to go back and change something at the beginning of the book because of a discovery I made about the story or the characters later on. Over the course of writing The Lecturer's Tale, I made two discoveries about Professor Victorinix which caused me to go back and change passages that I thought I had already finished. One was that Professor Victorinix was not a minor character, but one of the major characters in the book. For example, she turns out to be one of three major characters who take part in the big, over-the-top climax of the novel. And, in keeping with the supernatural flavor of my satire, I also realize that Professor Victorinix was probably a vampire. I never made this explicit, because the supernatural element in the book was mainly a vehicle for my satire of contemporary literary theory, but I did want to have some fun with the idea. These two discoveries, that Professor Victorinix was a major character, and that she was even scarier than a mere English department chair, forced me to go back to that opening scene when I was nearly done with the whole book and revise it to reflect her new status. So here's the opening scene as it appears in the finished book. Crossing the quad on a Halloween Friday, as the clock in the library tower tolled 13 under a windy, dramatic sky, Nelson Humboldt lost his right index finger in a freak accident. Someone called his name three times out of the midday press of students, and as he turned to answer, Nelson stumbled over a young woman stooping to the pavement behind him. Falling backwards, he threw his hand out to catch himself, and his finger was severed by the whirring spokes of a passing bicycle. Only minutes before, in the shadowy office of Victoria Victorinix, the English department's undergraduate chair, Nelson had lost his job as a visiting adjunct lecturer. He had sat on the far side of Professor Victorinix's severely rectilinear desk, his hands tightly clutching his knees, while she told him with a cool courtesy that the department was forced by budget necessities to terminate his appointment at the end of the semester, only 6 weeks away. "You have our gratitude, of course," she said, folding her slim hands in the icy blue light of her desk lamp, "for all your efforts on behalf of the department." Professor Victorinix was a small, slender, thin-lipped woman with cropped silvery hair and a bloodless manner barely masked by a disinterested politess. Even during the day, she kept the blinds of her office drawn, and today she sat in the shadows just beyond the direct glare of the lamp. The reflected glow off her desktop emphasized the sharpness of her cheekbones, the deep groove between her eyebrows, the smooth skullcap curve of her forehead. She regarded Nelson with a gaze that seemed to him aristocratic, ancient, bored. Under the circumstances, she said, "I realize that our gratitude may not mean much to you." Nelson swallowed hard and tried not to cry. His own gaze, in order to avoid